I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The book Vancouver Confidential continues to sell well, and a couple of weeks after its editor John Belshaw was in to talk about it, I'm joined now by Jason Vanderhill, a contributor to the book. His piece entitled The Daniel Joseph Kennedy Story is a fascinating one, and I'll get him to tell us about. I'll also ask him about his terrific work chronicling history through his very fine website, Illustrated Vancouver, and his Flickr, Instagram, and Twitter accounts. His Flickr account alone features several thousand images, some he took, some he recovered, and all now stored electronically there thanks to his keen eye for the artistic and the historic. Very quickly, when you get acquainted with his avocation for Vancouver, do you see him at the intersection of art and history, pulling us toward aesthetically interesting work, work that remembers who we are, and perhaps gleans some insight into where we're headed? I've asked him to appear on the program to tell us about his piece in Vancouver Confidential, which, incidentally, is published by Arsenal Pulp Press, but also about his work as an amateur historian. His work online and elsewhere is really adding to the collective memory that we all should be cultivating. In his pursuit and showcase of art and ephemera, he's quickly become a treasure himself. The website for Illustrated Vancouver is at illustratedvancouver.ca. The Twitter is at JMV, whilst the Instagram account is instagram.com/Jason Vanderhill. And, of course, the Flickr account can be viewed at flickr.com/JMV. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Jason Vanderhill. Mr. Vanderhill, good morning.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. I'm one of those people that first encountered you online, thanks to someone sharing something that you found online. How long have you been cultivated this online presence of yours?
Indeed. Well, I think that goes back to my arrival in Vancouver, which is now just over 10 years ago. And it was around 2004. I really had no business coming to this city except to see my sister and spend some time with her as she got set up for a new job here. And so I stuck around for a few months, and it took me a while to get acquainted with the city. But slowly and surely, I was won over by a whole lot of questions that I had about the city, rather than answers. I couldn't particularly find my way through the city. I couldn't find the downtown, or I couldn't seem to really understand where is it that I want to shop? Where do I need to go? What do I need to see? So it was a real process of discovery, and thankfully, from the very beginning, literally in the first month I arrived, I came across Word on the Street, which is a great place to come together, and that's where I met John Atkin, and he was giving a neighborhood walking tour, and that really hooked me. Like, I was immediately informed about sort of the unwritten history of the city when you look at the buildings and the architecture that's there, the things that are missing. It was a real informative introduction that had me hooked.
So you obviously weren't born here. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in southwestern Ontario in the modestly sized town of London. I went to school in Toronto, and that sums up my urban background.
You know, it's fascinating, because I didn't know this about you until I just asked you where you're from. Did you find that most people that come here are more zealous, if you will, about Vancouver history? I mean, I can name four or five people, including yourself now, who have come here from other places and have become just marvelous historians. I've lived here my whole life, but I mean, I don't know probably half of what you know or what you know about the city, and I'm sure I'm like a lot of people in this town.
It is a trend, and I think it has oft been repeated. I think of John Mackey, who came from Winnipeg, I believe. And even John Atkin came over from Victoria for art school, and he never left.
Chuck Davis was from Winnipeg, too, wasn't he?
Chuck Davis may well have been, I think. So right there.
Yeah.
You've got three heavy hitters. And I, for a very long time, did not really see myself adding to the story. I was absorbing a whole lot, just taking it all in, taking it all in. And I think it was sort of a combination of being at the right time at the right place, and social media starting to explode. And really, it was Flickr came first. And it was photography. It was meeting up in these social photo walks, and seeing the people that you've seen online now in real life, and getting to know them through their interests, and that was also really informative. So my introduction to the city was very photographically based,
yeah.
And it progressed, led more deeper and deeper into history through, I think, a lot of the digital resources that have become available.
And, you know, it speaks to, I guess, our lack of memory. I mean, did you find that? That we don't really appreciate history as much as we should?
Yeah, and for me, as a newbie coming to the city, not really knowing what things look like beyond 10 years ago. I missed out on Expo 86.
Yeah.
So even something as recent as that, I was really curious. Like, where can I see a great photo archive? Where can I see what are the relics that are left over from Expo 86? And so immediately we go to the internet and we look for these things. We Google them, we try and search, and I found little relics of, oh yeah, these park benches from Expo are now over here. Or this little cart from some display is now hanging up in this recycled shop out in Burnaby. The one single thing that I wanted to see more than anything, mm-hmm. from Expo was Highway 86.
Mm.
And I thought it was a really profound, even as a kid, I thought, this is amazing work of contemporary art.
Yeah.
And I really knew nothing about art, but I just loved that whole concept of seeing this wavy ribbon of a freeway just sort of dipping into False Creek.
It was all silver, right?
It was made to look like everything was made out of concrete.
Yeah.
And sadly, that none of that really was preserved. And one little relic that I did uncover, I kind of learned how it was sort of auctioned off through, you know, a couple paragraphs of text in an old art magazine that... It'd be really, really hard to find that information any other way, but magically I just stumbled across it one day, and it's like, ah, that's how it happened. They tried to save some of it. Ended up auctioning off bits and pieces of it. So that's a good example of something that I do miss. But it's also the story of architecture. I mean, we're interested in what buildings used to look like, and that's what a lot of the house history work also explores. And coming at it photographically, when we do find a photograph that really captures the essence of this place or the building, it really sets your imagination alive. And so I do like that common then and now.
Yeah.
To recapture the same scene and see what's changed and what's stayed the same.
As citizens, as residents, we are keenly aware of how the city is changing. And so we do need to look back. If we don't look back, it's gone, essentially, right? So,
yeah, it can happen very quickly. And it's not a story that's specific to Vancouver, but I think just the accelerated rate that we've seen it has made it just that much more pronounced. But you can take these themes and you can apply them to probably any city in North America that, look, things have changed. Buildings, construction styles, appearances, some things, industries completely just disappear and vanish. And it also helps that Vancouver, mm-hmm. is such a picturesque environment. Like, when the conditions are favorable, photographs can look absolutely amazing, like a picture postcard.
At the end of your essay in Vancouver Confidential, there's a wonderful line, and I'll use that, and then you can tell us about how you came to write about Daniel Joseph Kennedy. The line is, the smallest artifacts can be gathered to tell a story. And I guess you had found something, had you? Is this how you came across this guy, Kennedy?
Yes, that's the perfect entree to the Kennedy story, because I would not have been challenged to explore, to write it, were it not for one collector, one Vancouver collector who has a great collection of ephemera, objects, souvenirs, and he had three bottles, labeled, paper-labeled bottles, with the name Joseph Kennedy Limited on them.
Huh.
And that was enough. I was hooked. It was like immediately, I have to know the story. Who is this Joseph Kennedy? And could it be? Surely it couldn't be JFK's father. That's immediately everyone's presumption. And so, you know, you'd start with a question like that and you'd go online. And fairly quickly that's answered or somewhat answered. There's a couple of important biographies that have mentioned him in passing from the American perspective. Oh. Daniel Okrent wrote the book Last Call, History of Prohibition. And so our Joseph Kennedy gets a mention, and Daniel sort of debunks the myth that it was JFK's father. It was not JFK's father, who was in Vancouver bootlegging alcohol at that time. He had other interests. He was in film. He was in interested in Hollywood, and ends up buying up RKO and eventually does get back into the family business. But that provoked me to try and dig as deeply as I could into all the archives that I could possibly find to try and tell his story. And so I was at the mercy of these archives. And I do think it's a story that I could not have written without the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story that I couldn't have written without, you know, the traditional or even just the idea of calling up someone in Missouri or Saskatchewan. And those were my biggest breaks, because thanks to, first, Vancouver Public Library has posted our city directories online. And that's huge. Like, that's almost the first step, the first place to go to try and find out information of what did the street look like, who lived here. And so that gave me some clues that, Joseph Kennedy starts, he appears around 1917 and 1819, 20, 20, 23, there's a name change. So I knew early on something that most people didn't, that Joseph Kennedy also went by the name Druggists Sundries Company Limited. And that was a sort of a big clue, because it sounds very obscuring. What is this actually about?
Mm-hmm.
It was right around the time we had our prohibition. And in fact, it was masquerading the fact that he's selling alcohol during prohibition as a medicinal cure. And that was his entree into at least our market. And
But his life was more fascinating than simply that. I mean, you really sketch his whole life out. It was his time here in Vancouver. So why is he an important figure in our history? And why haven't we known about him as much, say, heretofore?
Yeah, those are very good questions. I think the industrial history of our city is one that's very easily forgotten. If you don't have the corporate heritage to actually write the company biography, if you don't have continuity in these industries, then so much of that is lost. And it's not just Joseph Kennedy. It's the whole early brewing and distilling industry. Like, we don't have a really comprehensive book on the Rifles or Doering and Marstrand. And now all of those industries, the craft brewing, the small craft distilling, they're all making a huge resurgence. And it all seems very new. Like, this is great that Vancouver has this. Well, we had that from day one. Like, that was one of the key industries that got started here. And most of it has vanished, But thankfully, there are a whole bunch of people, it's not just me, who are endlessly fascinated by discovering these new little clues, or you find a new bottle. I joined the bottle club specifically so that I could get more leads on how do I tell Kennedy's story. And I have thankfully acquired one more known example of a Kennedy bottle through a member of the bottle club. And so now I have one, and my friend has three. And they're featured in the book. I photographed the bottles.
Yeah, and they're just wonderful to look at because they're obviously old pieces of bottles, and they have labels, and it's just interesting to read this stuff on them and to look at the shape and the sort. You must have a vast collection of ephemera like that.
I do try and build it. I don't always feel the need or the compulsion to actually own it.
Uh-huh.
Often it's just to see it,
yeah,
and to photograph,
yeah,
it and post it to Instagram and get it out there, because a lot of the times the really rare and obscure stuff is extraordinarily expensive. And there's a limited number of people who are actually buying and selling, but usually the good stuff doesn't come up for sale either. The people, they just want to hang on to it because they really value and treasure this. And so it's their way of holding on to the history of the place where they feel they belong.
So what of our time should we be keeping? I mean, it would become pack rats.
Yeah, it is really challenging. I wonder, you know, those city directories were really important, and I don't know if the library continues to save phone directories, because that was really significant for me, tracing where he grew up and the census as well. Census information, that's a huge debate now that a lot of that private personal information is getting locked out,
yeah,
for 100 years. You won't be able to use that as a research tool. But there are other things that we gain by the nature of the web. People share a whole lot more information. So you can pull some of that extraneous information out, but it won't be as maybe organized as it once was.
Yeah.
It's a little more chaotic. I'll go back to the start for me was through photography, and I think there is a lot more photography that we can be actively saving, preserving. I personally have this weakness, fascination for early home movies, and those are getting quite rare and obscure now. People, I'm sure just about every household probably had a number of maybe 8mm films, occasionally 16mm films in their basement with a projector they'd haul out in the 60s, 70s, 80s. But by the time the digital camera came on the market and could shoot movies, suddenly the old film camera seemed very antiquated and far too expensive to continue to process. So all of that just gathered dust. And sadly, I think a lot of it went out the door into the landfill. So I'm out there trying to reclaim these old films. And thankfully, I've rescued a few really great examples of color Kodachrome in the 1940s. I've digitized them and donated them to the Vancouver Archives. So some time in the near future, they will be added to the collection and they'll be probably screened at one of their annual film screenings.
I mentioned off the top your Flickr account, and that is widely subscribed to, widely viewed by people online. How many files, photos are on there, on your account?
Right. Well, I counted not too long ago, but I've forgotten. There's not that many photos, maybe 20,000.
Yeah.
But about a year ago, I think it was a year ago, I hit the landmark of 1 million views. And then within a very short time, I exceeded 2 million views. So I may have the dates wrong, but I'm well over 2 million views on Flickr. I have far fewer, I also have some things posted on YouTube, and some of those get extraordinarily popular as well. And I've had, I think, over 1 million YouTube views.
On the Flickr account, I don't have Flickr, but I'm assuming it's like most social media sites. Do you see what people of the 2 million views that you've had, or 2 million or more? Do you know what the most popular thing is, or?
I can see some trends.
Yeah, I'm interested in the trends because I'm curious to know what of Vancouver are people wanting to see.
Ironically, my most popular photo for the very longest time was terribly unfortunate. I was down to the last little bit of space on my memory card, and so I shot a frame at base resolution, so it's 640 by 480, and I entitled it Fall in Vancouver. And it was this Japanese red maple leaf that I just held up over Granville Island, the marina. But it was so perfectly framed with the clouds and the sky and the boats, and it was really such a beautiful landscape that I immediately could tell this is going to be a popular image, and it looks great as a thumbnail. It's very clickable. And so that, for a long time, was my single most popular image. There was like 20,000 or more views on that. And then, curiously, I think it has more to do with Google than the actual content, but my second most popular image now maybe has exceeded Fall in Vancouver, is a bit of a remixed gift that I did. I made a modern Iranian Barbie. I called it the supermodel NGO scientist delegate Baharbi, and I had dressed up this Barbie who, I think initially maybe she was Hispanic, but I made her look Iranian, and everything was black, 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 black. And it was kind of my tribute to Nazanin, because I had met Nazanin in Vancouver on one occasion. So I looked up to her and a lot of the work that she's done. She's done a lot of work for the UN and speaking out. So I thought it was time maybe to come up with such a bold product, to have an Iranian Barbie. And so that became very popular. It has nothing to do with Vancouver.
Yeah, see, I was thinking that some of your more popular views would be, some of the transportation stuff, maybe some of the architectural things, like the just pictures of edifices from the street.
Yes, and I learned early on, it has a lot to do with how you tag and describe your photos, and I was very good at that early on. If I knew the exact address, the name of the building, if you can put the date, you put all that information in the tags and fields, you'll get like anyone who's looking for that building. They want to see what it looks like. Oh, there it is. And sometimes they just want to know in passing, oh, what does this building look like today? Or I'm going to the neighborhood. What will I see? So I used to be much better at tagging and naming and describing things, but the volume of photographs too, that now I might spend a day photographing and I'll have 100 photos, and I've edited it down. I've kind of narrowed down the kind of images that I want to keep for my own purposes, and they're all sort of titled the same. So I may be not, and I may be missing out on some of that targeted audience. Also, I've noticed a lot of the conversation on Flickr sort of migrated to other platforms, and the discussions that people were having were really, really intense, and there's a lot of back and forth. And now that's much more common on Twitter or Facebook or pretty much any other medium other than Flickr. So it's quite rare that I get these extended conversations, but a really great resource on Flickr is still the Vanishing Vancouver group. It's an amazing collection of images that all of these members are sort of curating, and they find something and it's like, oh, I know who will like this. Vanishing Vancouver, this is great. So
is that the site where they have the old photograph and then they put that next to the new photograph?
Not necessarily, but no? There is some of that. Vanishing Vancouver is a lot of photos by the same members. You'll see a lot of demolition of buildings. off the top of my head, I can't recall.
Like the Carolyn Adderson thing?
Yeah, she is maybe a member. She's involved, but I think she has her own.
Yeah, she has her own blog
and Facebook as well.
The other thing that just struck me as we were talking is you have a day job, and I'm assuming that has nothing to do with the stuff that we've been talking about in the last few minutes.
Yeah, pretty much. I am by day a civil servant, so I work for the federal government. But there are a lot of the same sort of skills that I can employ just in terms of working in the digital medium. You know, I do scanning of things and file managing and cataloging and archiving. It's more being like a librarian of data.
Yeah.
And so there are some comparisons that you can make, but... Yeah, that's probably the extent of it.
Do you get asked why you do what you do in terms of your this avocation of yours and in being a historian as you are?
By inquisitive people like yourself.
I'm leading to it, yes.
You know, this is sort of a new world for me. I've never been published in a book before, and I never actually had that strong desire like some people are. I want to write this book. I've got to get published. And I kind of inserted myself into this collection when I heard about it just because I thought I had the perfect story. It's like, oh, this is the perfect venue. Because my Kennedy story had languished as a blog post. It was always going to be just another blog post on Illustrated Vancouver. And it was just draft mode, and it stayed that way for probably 2 years. And then finally I realized, no, wait a minute. This story is too good. I've got to get it in long form. I've got to get it in print somewhere. So I heard rumors that John Belshaw was putting together this collection, and I just emailed him blindly and said, say, I think I have a story for you.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
Literally. Yes. There's a so-called Belshaw, he's called it the Belshaw Gang now, I guess, or someone, one of your associates
That's
has.
That's right.
Daniel Francis on this program called it the Belshaw Group. But I think Belshaw Gang has a better ring, especially with the subject of the book.
Yeah.
What's it like to be part of that group? Because you have people like yourself who do this, amateur is not the right word, but the avocation, I guess I've used it already, as well as there's some folks in there who are published authors, some who are academics. But what it speaks to, I think, is this groundswell of, I don't know, affection, appreciation, enthusiasm for history, and you're at the center of all of this. What do you make of not only you guys who are doing this, but the reaction then had, because books like this have sold quite well, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think that is perhaps the lead story with this whole book, how successful it was as a collaboration. And I didn't know how I would work in the group I didn't know how we would collaborate or cooperate or what it would even look like, but things fairly early on were giving some good indicators, and I could tell, okay, I think we have a recipe here, because there's enthusiasm, we're learning about the areas of expertise, what people are going to be talking about. And so I've always sort of collected a lot of these artifacts, and it's like, I think I know someone will like this, and someone will like this. So I came just with a bundle of stuff one day when we had a meeting, and just started spreading it around, and I think that really helped to break the ice, and people really became interested, and they opened up, and it kind of felt a little bit like those early days of Flickr when we met in real life for the first time, and we got to interact and share, and that's progressed continually to this day. We're still volleying back email messages back and forth, and I don't think we would have been nearly so imposing had we not met in person. If we knew, you know, someone has written this book about that, you might email someone once or twice, but you're not going to establish this rapport where you keep in touch and you share to that extreme. So
it's a great demonstration as someone who's a reader, someone who appreciates history. This group that's come together, it's a real service to our history, I think. And I suspect, because the book is there and the book will be read for a number of years, it'll be there for a number of years, I think, and people after us.
Yeah, and that's what I like
to
seek
it. Yeah.
It's a multi-generational group, and that's also important to help to continue to inspire the next generation. And I did have a Chuck Davis story.
Yes, please.
I was going to tell you when I first came to Vancouver, I mentioned I'd met John Atkin, and fairly shortly, well, within a few months or years, I had learned that the Vancouver Historical Society wanted to do this documentary film about the earliest surviving motion picture of Vancouver. And so I joined the committee, and that was the City Reflections Program. So Chuck Davis was on the board, Andrew Martin from the library, and Mary Lou, and myself, and Ernst, and a whole host of others. And so we would have these board meetings at the VPL in the boardroom fairly regularly, once a month. And so Chuck Davis would always be there telling his story, and he always said he's been bitten by the history bug, and there's nothing he can do about it. And so he had this enthusiasm. Whenever he'd find this artifact, he'd always want to tell and share and show us. And so I used to get driven home pretty much every meeting by Chuck. So he'd be telling stories all the way home, driving down Kingsway or whatever. So I had a very good dose of some good counsel from Chuck, and I think that's probably partly why he's maybe to blame for the infection of history.
And all of you in Vancouver Confidential,
yes,
as I told Belshaw this, are inheritors of that enthusiasm, because he was Mr. Vancouver, as they say.
Yes.
And now that he's gone, it's so great that there are so many of you now that are doing this.
Yes, the legacy continues, and history carries on. Another one of my real strong desires is I hope that other cities are inspired, that it's not just Vancouver that reads this book, but other places see this and see how successful you can put together this somewhat eclectic body of work. The stories don't all connect, but there are some parallels and connection that weave its way through, and I think we could have many more of these type of books.
And so you've obviously heard from readers in the several weeks that the book's been out. What do they tell you? I mean, they obviously appreciate a book like this coming out, don't they?
I have heard some very enthusiastic responses. I love it when you see someone and their eyes just light up, and Maurice is a good example of that, and he was just thrilled. He's like, "Oh, your chapter is so great. It's all new. It's all new information. I had no idea. I didn't know any of that." So I kind of expected that, because my chapter is largely uncovered territory, and his story was lost for many years, even to the point where I think his own family, the descendants of Daniel Joseph Kennedy, don't really know the story, and that was one of the sad things. I never got to interview anyone from his family, so I never got in touch with them. And I could see 10 years ago they were on the genealogy websites looking for information. Does anyone know Daniel Joseph Kennedy and his wife Mary Hogan? And they had one daughter. And 10 years later, I know I have a whole lot of answers, but have not yet gotten in touch with them. So I hope through word of mouth someone recognizes and passes the word on to the family, and then that they pick up a copy of the book and are just blown away by the story.
And I'm sure there are hundreds, thousands, if not more than that, stories just like his that are just waiting to be uncovered.
Oh yeah, and that's where you need to be proactive with history, and so there needs to be more of that storytelling, that narrative, that recording of conversation. And we take it for granted, like we do take more photographs than we need, but we're not recording interviews. We're not recording stories, even of our own family members. And then when you realize that they're gone, it's like, oh, I don't even have a recording of the sound of their voice. So, yeah, I feel guilty that I don't do as much sort of audio preservation, because I used to be big on that. I used to record, like, radio shows when I was in high school and had them all on cassette tape.
Yeah. You're obviously writing still online, but are you thinking of writing something more than that? Maybe a book of your own, perhaps?
It does seem to lead to the next book. And I'm at a really difficult point right now because I have about 4 books that I'd like to work
These
on.
Ideas, yeah.
So I have some great ideas. Again, they delve into the archives. Vancouver City Archives has some great unexplored material that I think would look fantastic in print and to be really explored at length. But, you know, again, it's like the Kennedy story. There's an artifact there. We have part of the story, but there's very few secondary sources, secondary places where you can go to get the rest of the story. So there's a lot of footwork involved.
Before I let you go, you mentioned the Vancouver Historical Society, one of a few organizations in the city that I'm sure you're a part of that you have used resources like the Police Museum, Museum of Vancouver. Tell us about what you find that people like myself say haven't been to or utilized as much that we ought to.
Okay, well, the great thing is that there is more than just one repository, and all of these archives have different materials. So you may not have had a reason to visit UBC Special Collections until you find out that they have the greatest collection of CPR. And when you find out that the police museum has all of the records that they have, suddenly if that ties into your story, it's crucial. And it's amazing that some of these archives were so fragile and so close to being lost completely. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes it comes down to one person, you know, standing there with boxes saying, we've got to save this. And making a phone call, calling someone and says, get down here right now with a truck and rescue this material. So I know that's happened on more than one occasion.
The archives. I've never been to the archives. That's by the planetarium, I guess, on Chestnut. Is that right?
Yes.
That's something that anybody can just go in there and visit, or is it?
Indeed, and I guess maybe one of the reasons why some people have stayed away. They're open weekdays, so you can't visit on weekends. But the amazing thing is they have such a proactive online agenda to get this material on the web as much as possible.
There's so many photos online now, right?
The photos is huge, and I think they're probably world class in that respect. To be archiving that much material and the era and the breadth of the material that we can look up in Vancouver and any other city, if you don't have that archive, it means a whole lot more legwork of going to these places and flipping through card catalogs and filing cabinets, and it's a much older way of doing research.
Jason, I met you, I guess, at the book launch for Vancouver Confidential, and it's a pleasure to see you again. But more than that, it's a chance for me to tell you how much I appreciate all the work that you've done online, and I'm not alone in that. I think there's a lot of people online who have become fans of yours because of the great work that you do, and so I could talk all afternoon with you. Thanks for coming in to do this, and continued good luck with all of your efforts.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the attention.
Vancouver Confidential, edited by John Belshaw, is published by Anvil Press. do pick it up if you haven't already. Not to sound trite, but there's something in here for everybody. And you'll find that you'll be reading everything and just fascinated by it. And then you'll, if you're like me, you'll go to the footnotes and want to read more, and you'll go online and look for more material that way. The terrific website, illustratedvancouver.ca. The Flickr account is at flickr.com/JMV, instagram.com/JasonVanderhill, twitter.com @JMV. Jason Vanderhill joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.